It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum of Solace, number 7. Well, I'm just back from Memphis and New York and somewhat jet-lagged, so I hope that this is coherent. We have a lot to look at, and hello to those of you from Memphis who are tuning into this for the first time. We're going to cover from the US, Australia, Scotland, the United Kingdom, and we'll see what else we can throw in as well. Let's begin with the remarkable tale of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, who is the former chief Vatican diplomat in the United States, and who has come out with a report which, amongst other things, identifies Pope Francis as somebody who deliberately kept back news of a serious child abuser or homosexual offender.
That the highest leadership in the Vatican had known about much of the sexual corruption in America and had known specifically about the allegations against the former Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Theodore McCarrick, as far back as the year 2000. Archbishop Vigano goes so far as to say that after the misconduct of Cardinal McCarrick was known, Francis actually reversed sanctions against McCarrick put in place by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, and drew McCarrick even further into the circles of papal influence.
Now, there are many, many, many different issues to say about this. We put a link to a story which is really quite extraordinary, where it seems as though the Archbishop has gone into hiding.
Now, all of this is already unprecedented, but Archbishop Vigano went further and directly called for the resignation of Pope Francis as Pope.
One of the other things, one of the other just incredible things in this story is how it's come out and what's really going on, because we don't know. There are those who argue that it's a very conservative cabal led by the Archbishop who are seeking to bring down this liberal Pope. On the other hand, there are those who see the Pope himself as being guilty, as the Archbishop has stated. And if he is, that has enormous significance. What I find fascinating is the extent to which the liberal press have not gone after the Pope for this, because in a sense, he's one of their own. That doesn't mean that he is guilty, but it does mean that there are some very, very serious issues here to be looked at. Now, another leader who's in a great deal of trouble is Alex Salmond, the former leader of the Scottish National Party and the former First Minister of Scotland, and certainly the most influential Scottish politician for many, many decades. What's the story? Well, he's resigned from the Scottish National Party because he doesn't want it to be caught up in arguments about accusations that have been made against him about sexual misconduct 2 or 3 years ago. Now, we don't know the details of this. They were published in the Daily Record to some degree this past week. And Mr. Salmond is understandably pretty upset about that. He denies all the accusation, and he deserves and should be regarded as innocent until proven guilty. Although, unfortunately, what happens in these cases is that, depending on your political perception, you tend to judge. And I don't think any of us should do that.
I think for the part of the SNP that I and he have been members of for 30 years now, it's always been a champion of fairness, equality, justice, for the notion that, you know, we shouldn't have one rule for the powerful and another rule for everybody else. So this is now about making sure that due process is allowed, that any legal processes, civil or criminal, are allowed to take their course, and in the interests of all parties, those who've brought forward complaints and Alex Salmond who has complained about, in the interests of all of those, for justice and for truth to prevail.
Why has he resigned then? People say he shouldn't resign unless he was guilty. Well, he's resigned from the Scottish National Party because he says that he doesn't want this to be an issue of division within the party, and that he will reapply and join again for whenever it's done, because he's been a member for 45 years, except for one brief period. And actually, I know that brief period quite well, because my co-founder of Solas, Gordon Wilson, was the leader of the SNP who suspended Alex during some turbulent years in the past. Now, again, what's extraordinary about this is that Mr. Salmond has raised, at the time of recording, over £80,000 in a kind of crowdfunder bid from the public so that he can have the fees, get this, to take the Scottish government to court for judicial review, because he is greatly concerned that this has been leaked to the press.
My beef is not with the people who've complained, it's with the Scottish Government administration, who've put a process which breaks every rule of natural justice. You don't get access to statements, you don't get access to witnesses. I'm not allowed to speak to any current civil servant, many of whom would have wanted to give evidence on my behalf. You're not allowed to prepare your own case. All I want is a just process, and therefore I'm going to the highest court in the land, the Court of Session, to get that fairness, which everyone's entitled to, those who complain and those who are complained about.
What all this means and where all this is going, who knows? But it is quite an extraordinary turn of events. Let's move on to something, and that's the death of Senator John McCain, who of course stood as the Republican candidate against Obama, who was obviously to become the president. Now, there are many things that could be said about McCain, not least his service for his country. But I think for me, that just the one thing that really stands out is his decency and the idea he had of respect. As you can hear in this clip, when a woman accuses Obama of being an Arab and I don't trust him and so on. And he deals with that in a wonderful way.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you. First of all, I want to be President of the United States, and obviously I do not want Senator Obama to be. But I have to tell you, he is a decent person and a person that you do not have to be scared as President of the United States. Now, look, if I didn't think I wouldn't be one heck of a lot better president, I wouldn't be running, okay? And that's the point. That's the point.
There is a great deal that today's politicians could learn in the febrile atmosphere of social media and everything that goes along with it. It is really important for us to respect one another and for politicians to respect one another. Now, of course, you can argue respect has to be earned. But I would argue as a Christian that all human beings are made in the image of God and deserve at least that respect, even if that image has been twisted and distorted and perverted. I think Senator McCain was a fine example of how to treat your opponents.
I admire Senator Obama and his accomplishments. I will respect him, and I want everyone to be respectful, and let's make sure we are, because that's the way politics should be conducted in America. So let's make sure that we're all respectful. Now, I don't mean that has to reduce your ferocity. I just means it's got to be respectful, okay? And I would say that 99 and 44 one-hundredths of every person who's come to my town hall meeting has been respectful, and I'm proud you're here, and I'm grateful for it, and I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Now let's turn to President Donald Trump, the current president in the United States, and his meeting, a rather extraordinary meeting, I think, on August the 27th with around 100 evangelical leaders in the White House for a dinner especially hosted for them. It was reported in various ways, and there was a group that met with him privately, although some of that has been reported as well, as often happens with these things. This was kind of dubbed a state dinner for evangelical leaders and was also attended by Vice President Mike Pence, the Homeland Secretary of Homeland Security, Ben Carson, and the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, and the Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback. Evangelicals who attended included Franklin Graham, James Dobson, Greg Laurie, Paula White, and others. And apparently it was a great and successful evening. Now, what do we say about it? First of all, we have to say it's a good thing. It's a good thing that a president is meeting with Christian leaders, although how they were selected and on what basis, I don't know. But I think that is a good thing. But, and you know that there's a but coming there. And that is something that just really disturbs me about this. President Trump, in effect, told the church leaders that he had given them what they wanted. He had provided them, as is his wont, he boasted that he had provided them with more than they had asked for, and that therefore they should support him. Not only should they support him, but instruct their congregations to do so. Now, here's where I have a problem. I think it is right and absolutely correct for church leaders to speak to those in power, but it is wrong and entirely wrong for those in power to co-opt church leaders or church leaders to allow themselves to be co-opted into one particular political cause. President Trump warned that if the Democrats were elected in the Senate and in the House in the upcoming November elections, and if he was to lose his place, then there could be a real pushback against the church. Now, how did we get to a stage where the church is so identified with one particular political party? To me, that's madness. It's wrong biblically, I'm sure of that. But it's also tactically madness. We do need to pray. Franklin Graham was right. We need to pray for the president. We need to pray for the country. We need to pray also, though, for those who are in opposition. And we need to make sure that we do not identify Christianity with one particular political viewpoint, whether it's of the right or of the left. One of the other things that disturbed me about this was the statement that rather than be kind of John the Baptist-like and critique some of the president's policy, it was described as being, well, it was a kind of loving. We were there to love and to show God's love in that way. I don't know. Does that not disturb you at all? I mean, imagine if John the Baptist had gone to Herod and said, well, you know, we just want to show him his love. Well, and there's a man, King Herod. He's committed adultery and many other things. And no, but we just want to show him God's love because he's in power and he can give us what we want. I just think this alliance between political power and the church is never good, no matter where it comes from, no matter how it is applied, whether it's the Catholic Church working together with the Communist Party in China, or at least apparently the Vatican, or whether it's some leaders, not all, some leaders of evangelical churches working with President Trump as though they were a branch of his government. That is not a good position to be in, and that will come back to bite the church. And you would think that we would have learned our lesson from the past, but this to me is a fundamental error. So we've talked about a politician who courts evangelicals, and another one who was neutral about them, and another one who would be strongly opposed. Let's come on to what has been described as Australia's first evangelical prime minister, Scott Morrison.
I, Scott John Morrison, do swear that I will well and truly serve the people of Australia in the office of prime minister, and that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Australia, so help me God.
After yet another parliamentary coup and another new leader, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull was ousted, and Scott Morrison, who apparently did not want him to go, has become the leader. And what is intriguing is the extent to which his Christian faith is being lampooned and being criticised. In particular, ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ran a skit in which they attacked his evangelical Christian beliefs. It was on the satirical television show Tonightly last Monday. Now, I think that his views on immigration, he was immigration minister in 2013, they're up for criticism. In fact, I think any of his views could be up for criticism. But I do wonder, did ABC run a skit when a Jewish minister was appointed? Would they run one if a Muslim minister, would they run one attacking or critiquing Mohammed? I very, very, very much doubt it. Well, what about Mr. Morrison himself? He is one of 2,000 worshippers at the Horizon Church, which is a Pentecostal church. And it will be interesting to see how that works out. He himself has said that his politics is not determined by his personal faith in Jesus Christ. And what he means by that is not that that doesn't have an impact upon him, but I think quite correctly. In contrast with what we looked at earlier, personal faith in Jesus Christ is not a political agenda, is what the new Prime Minister of Australia said. I think that American evangelicals who met with President Trump and President Trump himself would do well to remember those wise words. And I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. Finally, in the news is the astonishing news, at least again in the United States, that Michael Jackson's Thriller has been overtaken by the Eagles' Greatest Hits as the best-selling album of all time. Now, I actually love the Eagles' Greatest Hits and their album Hotel California. And the BBC had a fascinating article, which we put the link to, on what the words actually mean.
Everybody wants to know what that song is about. And
no, I've sung them many times, and I'm not sure I know what they mean. And it's quite fascinating when you look at the article. They just talk about a weary traveler being in a place of grotesque characters. My favorite use of Hotel California was the Greek foreign minister who said about the European Union that you can check out any time you want, but you can never leave. That just set me thinking, or at least Hotel California set me thinking about all what words mean and what songs mean, what the scripture means, what everything means. And we can't just make up meaning. It may have been that Hotel California had no meaning at all, but we certainly can't say that about scripture. We're absolutely clear that there is a clear meaning. Sometimes, even in the more obscure passages, it takes us a while to work out what it is. But Hotel California, Glenn Frey said, it means whatever the listener wants it to mean. No, we don't go that way with the Bible. Okay, that's it for another week. Again, I do apologize in the quality of my own voice because I am jet lagged. Just a thought for you. If you'd like this podcast to continue, we are going to have to fund it. And so we will be launching a funding appeal. If you want it to continue, that's what's going to have to happen. So please do get in touch. Do let us know. It won't take much, but it will take something. I'm afraid I'm not able to produce this. I don't have the technical skill, and nor do I really have the time to do all the work that's involved in putting this out. So I'm quite happy to provide the content, but I need Al, our old pal Al, I need Al to make the actual podcast. So if you can help at all, if you think this is useful, then please do contribute. Of course, if you don't, or you don't think it's useful enough to deserve any of your money, then that's fine. And we'll just take that as that's what we're supposed to do. But hopefully see you next week and the week after that, and indeed for many weeks to come. May God bless you all. Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge and oddly enough, but makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising, loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in this society, hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.